This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we find that the 2017 presidential election was not conducted in accordance with the principles laid down in the Constitution and the written law on elections, in that it was neither transparent nor verifiable. On that ground alone, and on the basis of the interpretation we have given to Section 83 of the Elections Act, we have no choice but to nullify it.
That's Kenyan Justice Philomena Mwilu explaining why she voted in favor of the petition challenging incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta's election win. Details next.
Also, United Nations experts warn that elections in South Sudan next year would be catastrophic. And in addressing the UN General Assembly, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said the Arab region is a hotbed for some of the most vicious civil conflicts in recent human history.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's Supreme Court released a ruling today explaining why it nullified the August presidential election. Justices put the blame on members of the Electoral Commission, who they say refused a court order to open computer servers and who announced official results before all tally forms had been received. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The roads around Kenya's Supreme Court were cordoned off Wednesday, and police dispersed protesters from the ruling and opposition parties who had gathered outside. Inside, justices spent more than 7 hours explaining why they ruled that results of the country's August 8th presidential election would be nullified. Justice Philomena Mwilu was one of three justices to explain why she voted in favor of the petition, filed by Raila Odinga's opposition coalition, which challenged incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta's win.
We find that the 2017 presidential election was not conducted in accordance with the principles laid down in the Constitution and the written law on elections, in that it was neither transparent nor verifiable. On that ground alone, and on the basis of the interpretation we have given to Section 83 of the Elections Act, we have no choice but to nullify it.
Mwilu said the Electoral Commission, or IEBC, refused a court order demanding it open its computer servers. As a result, she said, justices had no choice
but to accept the petitioner's claims that the IEBC's IT system was infiltrated and compromised, and the data therein interfered with, or IEBC's officials themselves interfered with the data, or simply refused to accept that it had bungled the whole transmission system and were unable to verify the data.
In Kenya's electoral system, official tally forms were to be sent from all 291 constituencies and 40,883 polling stations to the National Tallying Center. These paper forms were to back up the electronic tally that was also sent to the center. The justices took issue with the fact that the IEBC announced official results before about a quarter of these paper forms had been received. In his comments, Chief Justice David Moraga said many of the constituency-level forms were incomplete, often lacking required signatures or IEBC features.
As we have noted, that out of 291 forms, 56 from that random sample, 56 did not have the watermark features, while 31 did not bear the serial numbers, and a further 5 were not signed at all. And the 2 were only stamped by the returning officers, but not signed. In addition, 2 forms were not signed by the agents.
According to Nairobi-based writer and political analyst Nanjala Nyabola, these procedures are important because they were put in place as a direct result of other electoral crises over the years. And she says the justices understand these implications.
They're not merely technicalities, but they're things that are protected and enshrined in law. They were saying to the IEBC, you don't get to pick and choose which parts of the law you obey, because if we allow you to do that, what's to stop the next commission, the next individual, the next institution from doing the same thing?
The IEBC announced that a meeting scheduled Wednesday with Jubilee and NASA would be postponed to a later date to allow the parties to consider the court's judgment and inform discussions on preparations for fresh polls. Currently, the rerun election is scheduled for October 17th, but the opposition is pushing for a later date. The Constitution dictates the poll take place within 60 days of the Supreme Court's ruling, which would be October 31st. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And as Kenya gets ready to repeat its presidential elections, some observers say they fear the elections could be influenced by fake news. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
In what appears to be a deliberate effort, Kenya has lately seen an increase in fabricated stories or fake news being used to influence certain outcomes. Media analysts say that fake news stories are more widely shared on social platforms such as Facebook and WhatsApp than mainstream media channels. Mark Kaigwa, founder of a Nairobi-based digital tech research company Nendo, says Kenya is at a crossroads given the widespread use of social media. He says WhatsApp has taken the lead as the most widely used social media platform in Kenya. But many are using it to spread false news, especially as the country awaits a fresh vote of another presidential election.
When you talk about fake news, I prefer the term false news. Mm-hmm. And there you can describe yellow journalism, which is the or propaganda outright. So even in very many different states, you have what's known as statecraft, which is ways that the state will now choose to use media outlets and what they call information operations. It's a technical term. Where you have nation states, there are media outlets and media-aligned operatives who are actually ensuring that they can dominate a news cycle with disinformation or misinformation because they know about the work and the protocols involved by some other nation states to just issue a statement that says this is not true. So it's a challenge and it's globally faced. It's certainly here in our election.
Earlier this month, Kenya's Supreme Court nullified President Uhuru Kenyatta's re-election and subsequently ordered a fresh presidential vote within 60 days. Since then, Kenyans have taken to Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp sharing all types of information. In a bid to check the spread of fake news, especially at the time of election in Kenya, Kaigwa urges Kenyans to be vigilant.
WhatsApp, according to Nendo, has over 12 million users in the country. That makes it, even though it is an instant messaging application, it makes it the battleground for facts, for information, for breaking news. There, it is critical that people scrutinize the links that are being shared, the information. Does it automatically seem to confirm existing biases and seem partisan in some way? So at the end of the day, what we're asking for is vigilance, because fake news is out there to try and tire us and fatigue us. We don't believe the press. We don't believe
Julian Kamau, an online editor with the Standard Group, one of Kenya's leading media organizations, says journalism has fallen prey to fake news. She cites an example where our organization was duped early last year into believing a fake story.
Fake news has affected journalism in that people don't know what to believe, and even when fake news is propagated, or rather journalists are duped or fooled into believing that fake news is real content. Standard Group has run the Eritrean women, being the fact that Eritrea has allowed people to marry multiple wives. We ran that story, but it was also an eye-opener of how damaging fake news can actually affect us, and it made us now look for solutions to curbing that.
The story, which was shared across Africa, alleged that Eritrean men had been ordered to marry at least two wives. Eritrean officials dismissed the story, saying it was a hoax. In another example, a false story circulated on the social media during the elections that a member of the opposition National Super Alliance had defected to the ruling party. It's not clear who was behind the story, nor if it swayed any votes. Joseph Nasongo, an official from Kenya's National Cohesion and Integration Commission, NCIC, says fake news is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Fake news is again a point of concern. As a commission, we are concerned with propaganda that is directed at stirring up negative emotions that would lead to violence.
According to Nasongo, the commission is currently investigating several cases of fake news created to heighten tensions between various ethnic groups. Kenyan officials say new regulations outlawing the spread of false news are set to be introduced when a new law, the Computer and Cybercrime Bill of 2017, is enacted. It would penalize anyone who hacks into critical information infrastructure, including those regarding elections. The opposition claimed Kenya's electoral commission systems were compromised, casting doubt on the vote. The commission said it could not substantiate the claims. The bill would also penalize publishers of false, misleading, or fictitious data meant to influence elections or governance. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
As the UN General Assembly session continues in New York, a high-level meeting was held today on the humanitarian situation in South Sudan. Among those taking part was Mark Lowcock, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. He said the crisis in South Sudan could spiral out of control if leaders don't find a peaceful solution to the nearly four-year-old conflict.
UN agencies and NGOs have arrested famine in the Leer and Mayandit counties of Unity State, but the conflict has caused the number of people just one step away from famine to increase from 1 million to at least 1.7 million since February. But the suffering goes far beyond hunger and malnutrition. In this conflict, civilians suffer widespread, egregious human rights violations by armed actors on all sides. Thousands of villages have been burned and looted. Rape and gang rape are systematic and widespread. Children and women are forcibly abducted into fighting forces. The country is facing its largest ever cholera outbreak. And one in three of South Sudan's schools has been destroyed, damaged, occupied or closed, leaving the country with the lowest school enrollment in the world.
Lowcock says 4 million people are now displaced, 2 million inside South Sudan and the rest in neighboring countries.
Aid agencies are doing all they can, but the operating environment in South Sudan is increasingly hostile. South Sudan is still the most dangerous place in the world to be an aid worker. This year alone, at least 18 have been killed, taking the toll to 85 since the conflict began. Others continue to be harassed, detained, arrested, and delayed by deliberate bureaucratic impediments. Despite all this, humanitarians have helped or protected nearly 4 million people this year with food, livelihoods, water, and other essential help. Donors have been very generous. The South Sudan Humanitarian Fund has allocated nearly $600 million and the Central Emergency Response Fund over $250 million since the conflict began. But the appeal for this year faces a 35% funding gap.
That was Mark Lowcock, Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. South Sudan's first Vice President, Taban Dengai, also spoke today about the crisis in his country.
South Sudan is committed to restoring peace, and in this regard, the leadership of the country, both President Salva Kiir Mayardit and myself, as partners of peace, have agreed that there is no other viable option. As leadership in South Sudan, we share a good working relationship with the overriding goal of the transitional government of national unity to bring peace in South Sudan. We have no other option but to bring peace to the country. War is not an option. The government of national unity is also committed to the IGAD High-Level Revitalization Forum, and willing to have dialogue with opposition groups, while the transition government of national unity is expected to extend an olive branch. The same is expected of the armed opposition groups. The Tigono is committed to reaching to people that are interested in dialogue.
Dengai said that the country's dire economic situation could be one of the biggest spoilers of peace efforts. He admitted South Sudan is a dangerous place for humanitarian workers, but said the government is committed to guaranteeing access to aid agencies.
We also urge partners to consider allowing the protection of humanitarian convoys by government in areas where it is considered relatively unsafe, or in order to mitigate the incidence of deaths of aid workers and destruction of humanitarian relief. Your Excellency, we are being blamed of South Sudan being insecure country. Yes, this is true. South Sudan is insecure. But to be fair here, these agencies, in most cases, they don't allow the protection of our police or the protection of a convoy by our police or by our army. Sometimes they even refuse the protection of UNMISS.
That was South Sudan First Vice President Taban Dengai speaking today at the United Nations.
Meanwhile, United Nations experts warn that elections in South Sudan next year would be catastrophic and lead to more violence in the conflict-torn country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where a report on the humanitarian consequences of civil war has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council.
The Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan describes the humanitarian situation of millions of South Sudanese refugees and internally displaced people as almost unmanageable. The experts who visited Ethiopia and South Sudan between September 4th and 15th report shocking scenes of desperate refugees fighting to be registered. The experts say they saw people waiting in line collapse from hunger. In South Sudan's capital, Juba, they interviewed women who had been raped by soldiers and were unable to receive justice or recompense for their suffering. The commission says officials, including President Salva Kiir, told them they wanted to hold elections next year once the transitional government comes to an end. Commission member Godfrey Musila tells VOA, "This would be disastrous because such a government would lack legitimacy.
It would not be legitimate because a third of the population is displaced. Some of them are out of the country. It cannot be legitimate because political leaders, even the opposition that are abroad, some of them have been arrested and rendered back to Juba. They are not able to access the people to campaign."
Musila says the dormant peace process must be revitalized and a ceasefire put in place before an election can even be contemplated. Members of the commission agree. A hybrid court, which was approved by the African Union in 2013, must be established swiftly to hold perpetrators of serious abuses accountable for their actions. They say the people of South Sudan also need a commission on truth and healing. South Sudan became independent from neighboring Sudan in 2011 after decades of conflict. Less than 2 years later, the new nation descended into civil war after President Salva Kiir fired his deputy Riek Machar. The ensuing conflict has raged mainly along ethnic lines, with thousands killed and about 4 million people out of a population of 12 million displaced. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has delivered his country's address to the United Nations General Assembly. The Egyptian president said the Arab region is a hotbed for some of the most vicious civil conflicts in recent human history. He said such conflicts have made the Middle East and North Africa vulnerable to terrorism. El-Sisi said one out of every three refugees in the world today is an Arab, and the Mediterranean Sea has become a conduit for migrants from Asia and Africa. He compared African problems to the crisis in the Arab world.
This continent has also become subject to the same security threats facing the Arab region and constitutes a major example of the crisis in the current international economic order, which perpetuates poverty and economic disparity.
El-Sisi said Egypt has been at the forefront of countries that are keen on initiating the Nile Basin Initiative. He said the agreement is a legal framework that depends on cooperation and sharing between its three parties. It also relies on the good faith of the countries involved and a guarantee that they apply the agreement fully and with integrity.
we pursued the conclusion of a trilateral agreement between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia to address the Renaissance Dam issue from a cooperative perspective in a manner that establishes a clear legal framework to manage the issue in accordance with international law and established norms. And based on the well-established rules governing relations between states sharing basins of transboundary rivers all over the world.
The Egyptian president stressed that the only solution to the crises afflicting the Arab region is through upholding the notion of the modern national state. That concept is based on the principles of citizenship, equality, rule of law, and human rights. He said that applies to several conflicts in the region.
With regards to Syria, we believe there would be no salvation for Syria except through a consensual political solution amongst all Syrians, at the core of which is the preserving the unity of the Syrian state. Similarly, we believe that a political settlement is the only viable solution to the crisis in Libya. Libya continues to face attempts to dismantle the state and turn it into an open field for tribal conflict, a field of operations for terrorist organizations.
President El-Sisi said the same logic applies to the Egyptian strategy regarding the crises in Iraq and Yemen. He also made a plea to the Palestinians and Israelis to take advantage of a rare opportunity to achieve comprehensive peace. He said peace could come through a just settlement, meaning the establishment of an independent Palestinian state along the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. If this is achieved, the Egyptian president said the entire region could move into a new phase of stability and development.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the 72nd United Nations General Assembly opens with a theme focusing on people, striving for peace and a decent life for all on a sustainable planet. Host Shaka Sali and his guest will discuss the UNGA's theme and its importance for the people of Africa on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.